Okay, yeah, as we get started, just in case somebody's new here today, or they didn't get one of the books, we brought a few extra books that you can just take a complimentary copy later on this evening, that would be great. We're going to be talking about Blaise Pascal today, and in my book, No Other Gods, in one of the appendixes, I have a chapter on the apologetic methodology of Blaise Pascal. I agree with most of what I wrote back then. I think back then I had the wager argument as the final stage of Pascal's thought, his apologetic. And after further study, I decided that it should be moved up a little bit in the order. We'll talk about that. See, there's a problem with Blaise Pascal's apologetic methodology is he never finished writing his apologetic work. He died, he was 39 years old. Have you ever seen a portrait of Pascal or the cover of a book or anything? You look at him and you're kind of surprised he actually lived to be 39. Such an unhealthy looking guy. But whatever the case, his work was published, his notes, and they titled it Pensées, which means thoughts. And so nobody knows the exact order the Pensées would be in. So they just grouped these together, they numbered them, and it's anybody's guess. And so you have to read through it quite a few times until you try to figure out where's he going. I came up with a little different conclusion the last couple of years from the conclusion I reached years ago when I studied Pascal. We'll talk about that. You might want to jot this down. I sum up Pascal with what, six different words that begin with a D, okay? Try to make it a little bit easier. And the first D is Descartes. It is possible that Pascal's apologetic methodology, his apologetic work, his Pensées, these notes that he wrote when he was trying to put together a book in defense of the Christian faith, it's possible that it was as much a refutation of Descartes' apologetic methodology as it was Pascal's own defense of the faith. He was a contemporary of Descartes, Rene Descartes, and they were both into geometry and science. They were both brilliant men. They were both Frenchmen. But Descartes believed that man was this unbiased, rational machine that through unaided human reason, we could find all truth and solve all our problems. And this ended up backfiring, and Pascal pointed that out ahead of time. He was opposed to Descartes' ultra-rationalism or pure rationalism, and he said that man is more than just a rational being. He also said that reason is finite, and it's fallible. It's finite because, you know, the infinite God created us, but we're finite, we're limited. So our reason has limitations. And then also, we're fallible, we're fallen. So yeah, we can add 1 + 1 and get 2, but we can also add 1 + 1 and mistakenly get 3. Reason doesn't always get it right. So Blaise Pascal, I believe, had a much more realistic view of man than Rene Descartes. Man is more than just a rational machine. Now, he said things like this, the heart has its reasons of which reason knows nothing. Okay? So and by the way, when he says the word heart, he means the will, the emotions, intuition, anything you could learn by any other way than reason. And Pascal would argue, you know, probably 99% of the time when we come up with a belief, we human beings come up with that belief with anything else but reason. And then So we establish our beliefs apart from reason, and then once we have our beliefs, then we bring in reason through the back door. And we try to defend what we already believe on less than a rational basis. Okay? So I'll come out of the closet. I'm a Raider fan. Okay? And thank you, Diddy Brothers. Thank you, brother. I knew God would send someone here to talk to people. But especially after that horrible season. But you're a true believer. But whatever the case, you know, it would be like, you know, I like the Raiders. I like, you know, since 1967, I've watched them, and I like the silver and black. I like what they used to be, the meanest guys, the nastiest guys in the NFL. They played with, like, a New Jersey attitude, even though they were California guys. And so there's all kinds of different things that make me like the Raiders. So then if I get an argument with a 49ers fan, and I try to argue that Ken Stabler was a better quarterback than Joe Montana, that's when I start bringing my reason into the picture and I try to find reasons for it. But that comes in late. And I think Pascal had a much, much more accurate view of man. And so, and now the thing is that people might think, okay, well then Blaise Pascal was a phidias. He was an irrationalist. If he wasn't a rationalist, he must have been an irrationalist. He must have been opposed to reason. That is simply not the case. I don't know how people can read the Poncés and come up with that conclusion. You can read excerpts from the Poncés where he's slamming human reason. And he, to be honest with you, too, he doesn't really slam human reason that much, because he talks about the fact that man is just this tiny little speck in the universe, and one drop of water from the universe can destroy man. Yet man is still greater than the universe, because man knows he's being destroyed, and the universe knows nothing. Thus, all man's dignity is in his reason. I mean, so Pascal actually had a high view of reason, okay? But not so high that he thought that we could just find all truth and solve all our problems, the reason alone, like Descartes did. He actually had a high view of reason, but very little confidence, because man has fallen, that we would use our reason in an ethical and honest manner. Okay, so his apologetic methodology is very interesting, and in that it's kind of an apologetic methodology that is geared towards dishonest people, and Blaise Pascal believed that we're all dishonest people. So. Christianity for Modern Pagans was written by a Catholic philosopher, Peter Kreft. And he gives some of the Poncés, and then he gives a commentary on it. And that's a dynamite work. And I believe he dedicates the book to all of his Pascalian Thomas friends. And that sounds really strange, because you would think that Pascal would be totally opposed to Aquinas. And there's a big difference there. Aquinas liked the traditional arguments for God's existence, or at least five of them, and whereas Pascal hated the traditional. Well, he didn't hate the traditional arguments, but they were pretty much a waste of time. And so he was opposed to the traditional arguments for God's existence. At the same time, though, there are certain statements of Pascal that are ignored, which show that he actually held a rather high view of reason, and certain statements of Aquinas that are ignored, which show that his methodology had more humility than most people acknowledge. And you can see that, you know, Aquinas is just a little bit to the right of the center, and Pascal is just a little bit to the left of the center, but they're actually much closer than many people realize. But whatever the case, he was opposed to the traditional arguments for God's existence, because he said, he was even open to the possibility that they might be valid. But he said only a trained philosopher would be able to follow all that heavy reasoning. And even then, the trained philosopher was an atheist, and you convinced him of God's existence through reason, The next day, he'd forget all about the force of the arguments, and he'd probably go back to being an atheist again. See, this is what I like about Pascal. He understood human nature. You know, and you know, you can convince somebody of something, and they say, yeah, you're right, you're right, you're right. And 3 days later, they're saying the exact opposite. You're saying, what happens if I change my mind? Well, how could you be right on Monday, and then by Thursday, you're wrong? And that's just the way we humans are. He also said that, you know, so most people can't follow these arguments, and if you could follow them, you'd probably forget about the force of the argument the next day anyway. And then he said, even if you convinced an atheist that God exists, now what you have, he didn't put it in these words, but this is what it amounts to, all you would have now is a hell-bound theist. You have somebody who believes in God, and the guy's still going to hell. And Pascal always, he was always kind of in a rush. I mean, if he wasn't in a rush, you know, the technology you have today will probably not come around for another 30 or 40 years. I mean, this guy got the ball rolling in a lot of areas, and he died at age 39. So, I mean, this was a brilliant, brilliant thinker. But I think he was a little impatient. You know, what if I leave this atheist to believe that God exists? It might take 3 more months to convince him that Jesus rose from the dead and that Jesus is Savior. And by that time, he might be dead or I might be dead. And so he wanted to get right to the heart of the matter. Okay? So he said Descartes' view of reason is unbalanced. Again, he's not anti-reason, but he has very little confidence that man will use his reason in an honest manner. And then Pascal, I think he would make a great psychologist. Most psychologists today don't make great psychologists. But Pascal would make a great psychologist because he really understands. He says, if you want to convince people of something, you want to persuade them, you've got to start them with a subject that really, really interests them. And so he knows, knowing human nature like Pascal does, he starts with the person themselves. But you know, we're selfish. We're so selfish, and we're dishonest, whatever. And so he starts with man. He says, like, we've got a dilemma here. Because man is both wretched and great. When you talk about man's greatness, the universe could crush us and kill us with one little drop. Yet, at least we know we're being crushed. The universe knows nothing. Okay? So he's talking about man's greatness there. And then our wretchedness is the wretchedness, he says, of a dispossessed king. I mean, if there's any of them left by the end of the night, no other gods, you can get, I've got quite a few quotes from Pascal. Maybe we might be able to read a few of them. Here's one here in Ponce 84, Descartes. We do not think that the whole of philosophy would be worth an hour's effort. So, I mean, and you know, he's exaggerating there because he's doing some pretty good philosophy himself, but it shows how little patience he has for Rene Descartes when it comes to defending the faith. He says in Ponce 183, two excesses, to exclude reason, to admit nothing but reason. So he's saying that, you know, the ultra-rationalist like Descartes, he admits nothing but reason, that's excessive. But it's also excessive to be an irrationalist and to say reason should enter the discussion at all. He says in Ponce 188, reason's last step is the recognition that there are an infinite number of things beyond it. It is merely feeble if it does not go as far as to realize that. If natural things are beyond it, what are we to say about supernatural things? See, here's Descartes trying to prove everything to reason alone. He's saying, look, we can't, you know, there's an infinite number of natural things we can't figure out with reason. How in the world are we going to figure out supernatural things through reason alone? And then he says, this is 173, you could take this as a total slam on Descartes' attempt to prove Christianity and everything else through reason alone. Ponce 173, Pascal says, if we submit everything to reason, Our religion will be left with nothing mysterious but supernatural. Now, I'm getting chills up at my spine right now, and there's probably a few theologians out there that are as well, because, I mean, this guy is predicting the Enlightenment. He's predicting, like, deism and the result of that, atheism, because he's saying if we think that reason can figure out everything, our religion will lose everything mysterious and supernatural. That's what it led to. It led to the religion of Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, where God doesn't perform miracles. God just made the universe and just left it alone. A totally irrelevant God. Okay? And Jefferson and Franklin, their deism was a little bit more conservative than that. Divine providence, God could, it was worth praying, God could help you win the war. But today's deists are, God is, for all practical purposes, irrelevant. That's much like the French deists. Frederick Hopkinson, his 9-volume set of history and philosophy, does a real good job drawing a distinction between the anti-Christian French deists and the pro-Christian American deists. Who, Franklin and Jefferson thought Christianity helps our culture. And in France, they thought it was the first thing that we'd have to get rid of. So all of a sudden, we threw out the supernatural miracle-working God, and then before long, what's the difference between an irrelevant God, deism, and atheism, no God at all? I mean, so deism is just a halfway house between Christianity and atheism. And it's just amazing that there's so many churches that call themselves Christian today, and they really believe that man can perfect himself and solve all his problems. And you think after two world wars that we can figure out that, maybe we need to look to the heavens. But whatever the case, man is wretched. It's the wretchedness of the dispossessed king. It's not like we're messed up, period. I mean, it's like, you're never going to find a dog reading Summa Theologica, okay? So man's greatness. At the same time, there are some wretched things that human beings have done that you could never imagine the animal kingdom doing such things. And I don't even want to mention these things, but they're always in the newspaper for you. I mean, if I had a dime for every time I read it, some teenage boy set his grandmother on fire. I mean, this is more than just one animal killing another animal. This is a wretchedness that goes beyond that in the animal kingdom. But it's like we knew we were kings, and now we've fallen into poverty. And so Pascal's going to argue that only a good religion, an effective religion, an adequate religion, is going to have to explain both man's wretchedness and man's greatness. And he argues that Christianity does that by saying that man is great because he was created in God's image, and that man is wretched because he was fallen. But then he mentions death. Let me read this. This is a really good quote. I'll see if I have another one. He says, man is only a reed, or the weakest in nature, but he is a thinking reed. And he talks about what I said earlier when the universe is killing him. Here's the quote I'm looking for. Posse 434. Imagine the number of men in chains, all under sentence of death, some of whom are each day butchered in the sight of the others. Those remaining see their own condition and that of their fellows, and looking at each other with grief and despair, await their turn. This is an image of the human condition. So he says, you come into life, and eventually you reach the age where you figure out, I'm going to die. I've been attending funerals, and someday it's going to be my own funeral. And so we have to confront man's greatest enemy, death. He says this, "The last act is bloody, however fine the rest of the play. They throw earth over your head, and it is finished forever." And this is a pretty gruesome stuff. But Pascal believes, you know, I got to show my listeners how bad things are. Until they realize the bad news, how bad off we are, they're not even going to care about listening to me when I try to tell them the good news. He says, we desire truth and find ourselves nothing but uncertainty. We seek happiness and find only wretchedness and death. Then Ponce 148, God alone is man's true good. So, Pascal is really, he's really understanding the human condition. And he's saying, look, because of this dilemma, because of death, we've got to deal with that. But what do most people do? This is interesting. I like how Pascal puts this. He says, diversion. Being unable to cure death, wretchedness, and ignorance, men have decided, in order to be happy, not to think about such things. As Ponce 133. He said, in 166, we run heedlessly into the abyss after putting something in front of us to stop us seeing it. So it's just like, we know we're running towards the edge of a cliff, so just put a blindfold on and keep running, baby. It's great, you know. And then he says, I can quite see that it makes a man happy to be diverted from contemplating his private miseries by making him care about nothing else but dancing well. As Ponce 137. This guy's pretty good because he's talking about diversions. We divert our attention from the important issues like death and the paradox of man being both wretched and great. And trying to find a solution to our problems. We divert our attention. It's like I'm going to die. I'm wretched. Let's go dance. You know? And this is at a time when, I mean, you didn't have television. You didn't have radio. You didn't have computers. You didn't have computer games. You didn't have video games. Stuff like that. You know, I teach at a Christian high school, and my kids, they come to us. They're walking diversions. There's about, if you get a class of 20, you'd be lucky to have two or three with the parents monitor them enough to where, you know, this kid's getting more biblical input than media input. But the other 17 out of 20, you know, and it's scary too, because sometimes these kids will sound like they're on fire for the Lord in their youth groups and all this, and then you listen to the music they're listening to, and it's like, how is this glorifying to God? And if I get a chance later on in our conversation, I'll tell you how I get through to them on that point by kind of turning the tables on them. But it's just amazing. But we divert our attention. As long as you can just listen to music all the time or go out dancing and play video games, then you can just forget about the fact that you've got some big problems, the biggest of which is death. And you don't know the solution, and without the solution, life isn't even worth living. But you go right on living, and you go right on dancing. And I mean, these video games and stuff, I hear kids talking, Christian kids, about playing video games. You know, when I first went to King's West to teach there, one kid, he's a real good kid, real good Christian kid, too, by the way. So I'm not picking from the bottom of the barrel. He's in the weight room, and he's leaning against the wall, and he's talking to another pastor. So far, I've only killed 17 people, but as I get better, I think that number will increase. And he was talking about some new video game, you know? But he just, it's just a matter of fact that they know that they're talking about some virtual reality. And but they talk about it as if it's the real world. I mean, it's just going to get to the point where a guy is going to think he's a legend. He's going to think he's one of the greatest warriors or athletes who ever lived. And, you know, he's going to work at a fast food restaurant and do the fries during the day, never going to exercise at all, okay, never have a meaningful relationship with another human being, but he's going to put in his 8 hours, and then he's going to spend 10 hours that night, maybe more with all the caffeine, you can get a different way to get caffeine today, playing these video games or whatever, where, you know, he can do some virtual reality stuff, put on the helmet, and he's convinced. He's Rambo. He's convinced he's the baddest dude on the planet Earth. And in the real world, the guy can't fight his way to what they prevent, but he doesn't care. Because the real world's kind of irrelevant. You people are just kind of irrelevant. It's the universe that's on his virtual reality. Well, I mean, so diversion has become a form of worship. Pascal's arguments are even stronger today than they were back then. But now some people are honest enough to say, you know what? I'm getting tired of these diversions. You know, I can remember coming into the Marine Corps as a non-believer, and guarding nuclear weapons was so much more boring than what I thought I would be doing. Because we had hostages in Iran when I signed up. I didn't sign up to fight. I wasn't patriotic, but I just thought I was going to fight. I didn't know that while I was in boot camp, Ronald Reagan was going to get elected, and then Khomeini was going to start coughing up all the hostages before Reagan got inaugurated. And so it damned me to the 3 years of the most boring time in Marine Corps history. I mean, there's only like 3.5 years where they didn't even have the GI Bill. And my 3 years was like right smack in the middle of that. So that cost me tens of thousands of dollars right there. But whatever the case, you know, I was doing a lot of drinking and getting in trouble. And eventually, I got tired of that. And some people do that. They get tired of the diversions, and so sometimes they despair. They say, you know what? I can't defeat that. What if I build big buildings? What if I accomplish great things? In the end, I'm going to die anyway. It's not even worth it. And so you could despair. Francis Schaeffer used somewhat of a Pascalian approach. When he tried to show people that your worldview should lead you to despair, stop diverting your attention. You either despair or you look for deliverance, and you ask him, maybe there's some deliverance there. Maybe there's some answer out there that I haven't found. Now, let me show you. Is the pulpit blocking his last two? Yes. Can I move the pulpit? Is that right?
Yeah.
And you know, human pride and stuff, I'd probably be there for 30 minutes. I probably blocked you guys, didn't I? Well, now I used to put the wager at the end, and every Christian philosopher that talks about Pascal that I've heard so far puts the wager at the end, and everybody that I've read. And it's really not the climax, the final point of his argument. You know, I'm going to move the podium even more because I wanted to get into that. But whatever the case, his wager argument, yeah, I should just move it way over here. Let me just do it real quick. His wager argument is not really an argument for God's existence. You will never understand Pascal's wager argument if you think it's an argument for God's existence. Pascal's wager argument is an argument that the wise man will live as if God exists, even if he doesn't know that he exists. It's not an argument that God exists. It's an argument that you should hope that God exists and seek for him if you don't already know him. Okay? So he's trying to persuade you not to believe that God exists, but to hope that he exists. You see, Pascal believes that nobody uses their reason in an unbiased way. So he said, look, you're going to be biased. This is why I put the wager argument there. When you look at the evidence, you're either going to be biased against the evidence for Christianity or for the evidence of Christianity. And he says, here's why you should be biased for it. Because if you wager your life on God and you win, God exists, you get an infinite gain. Yeah, but what if you wager your life on God and he doesn't exist? You lose nothing. I mean, if you realize that if you're an atheist are in a car and you're debating back and forth, and a drunk driver swerves into your lane, hits you head on, and you both die instantly, a minute after you walk by, he can't even look at you and say, I told you, I was right. You know, if he's right, he's not even going to be able to know, because he can't even celebrate that he was right. So we don't lose anything. Okay, there's nothing to lose by wagering on God and possibility of an infinite gain. By the way, this is the guy that wrote the Laws of Probability. He was not a gambler, yet he's probably the world's foremost expert on what a good bet is. And then he said, well, what if you wager against God and you lose? God exists. Infinite loss. You lose everything. You lose eternity. But if you wager against God and you win, you win nothing. Absolutely nothing. Now, Pascal says, look, there's good thinkers who believe God exists. There's good thinkers that don't believe he exists. There's some supposed evidence that God exists, some supposed evidence that he doesn't exist. Reason can't settle the issue. Well, because he talks like that, some philosophers think that Pascal is saying the evidence is 50-50 for and against God. No, he's not saying that. What he's saying is, with our reason being so biased and our desire to flee from God, we make it look like it's a tough call, okay? But I think it was Richard Creel. Some philosopher wrote a really interesting paper on it and showed the strength of Pascal's wager. Let's say there's only a 1% possibility that God exists. Pascal's wager would still work. Okay? And here's how. Let's say your little child gets lost in the woods. And the sheriff's got a search party out there. They've been searching for 2 days. And the sheriff comes up and says, look, there's only a 1% chance that your child is still alive. Is it okay if we call off the search? What are you going to tell them? As long as there's any possibility, because there's so much to gain and nothing to lose, as long as there's any possibility my little baby's still alive, we keep searching, Sheriff. We keep searching. If there's just the slightest possibility that God exists, the wise man will continue to search. That's why Blaise Pascal said one of his ponces, real beautiful statement. There's only two kinds of people, said Pascal, that you can call wise. The man who serves God with all his heart because he knows him, and the man who seeks for God with all his heart because he doesn't know him. You see, if you wager against God with nothing to win and the possibility of infinite loss, that is a really, really bad wager. Okay? Now, when Pascal, with his wager argument, now he says, okay, so you should be biased. You should be seeking God. You should be hoping that God exists. Now look at all these prophecies that the Bible made hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, that have been fulfilled. Look at the prophecies that Jesus fulfilled. Look at the Jews, probably the most hated people on the planet Earth. Every major empire that came in contact with them tried to wipe them out. Well, those empires are gone, and the Jews are still around. And back then, they didn't even have land. How can you retain your national identity for thousands of years and you don't even have land? Pascal argues, you can't explain that any other way except supernatural protection. And then he talks about Jesus' miracles and finally the resurrection. I mean, it's amazing that people call Pascal, an irrationalist, when he, and I'll just close this session with this, it's amazing they can call him an irrationalist or a fideist when he presents evidence like this. Ponce 3:10, proofs of Jesus Christ. The hypothesis that the apostles were knaves is quite absurd. Follow it out to the end and imagine these 12 men meeting after Jesus' death and conspiring to say that he had risen from the dead. This means attacking all the powers that be. The human heart is singularly susceptible to fickleness, to change, to promises, to bribery. One of them had only to deny his story under these inducements, or still more because of possible imprisonment, tortures, and death, and they would all have been lost. Follow that out. Then in 3:22, the apostles were either deceived or deceivers. Either supposition is difficult, for it is not possible to imagine that a man has risen from the dead. While Jesus was with them, he could sustain them, but afterwards, if he did not appear to them, who did make them act? And so he uses these historical evidences for Christ's resurrection. By the way, we did that, the idea that the apostles lied. And he says, look, they're fighting the powers that be, these little fishermen and stuff, and just one of them cracks and it's over. Yet nobody cracks. Now, this is before Watergate. Watergate, it wasn't fishermen. Okay? It wasn't a tax collector and zealot. These are some of the most powerful, some of the most brilliant people on the planet Earth. And once the investigation started, one after another, this guy cracked. I'll name names. Just give me a smaller sentence. And it went on up the ladder. I'll name names. And President Nixon had to resign. And you're going to say that somehow Galilean fishermen were going to be able to hold out longer than an ex-Marine and Chuck Colson? People like that, and Libby, FBI agent, another former Marine. You can't keep a lie like that. They were telling the truth. And so I think Pascal's got a lot to offer us. And I think a lot more work is needed to really get to the bottom of his apologetic methodology. So we're going to take a break right now.
It's interesting that argument was used by
the rep.
Mike.
I'm not sure if this is on.
It is, but I haven't
heard it. Okay. Okay, so we talked about Blaise Pascal. The only other guy I want to get right into the 20th century traditional apologist. So the only other guy I'm going to just cover in passing, just real briefly, is William Paley. He's famous for one thing, and he should be famous for two things, okay? He's famous for his teleological argument regarding Jesus. That's the argument from design, okay? He gave that little story of, if you walked into the wilderness and you found a watch, and you had never seen a watch before, and you just picked up and you started to examine it, you would see that it was created for a purpose. And he goes into all this big, boring description of how a watch works, okay? And he says, now, when you look at that watch and you compare that to the human eye, the design in the human eye is so much greater, far surpasses it. So how come the watch needs an intelligent watchmaker? It's Paley's watchmaker argument. But the human eye got here by chance. He said that doesn't make sense at all. Now, a lot of people think that David Hume refuted William Paley's teleological argument. I just recommend read what Hume wrote on the subject and read Paley. It seems to me that Paley read Hume and was responding to Hume's objections. And so I just think the skeptics need to read Paley closer. And you'll see a reputation with you, not somebody who was refuted by the woman. In fact, they would get their dates wrong if they think that was the case. William Paley is famous for his watchmaker argument. I would even go further than that. And when you look at his historical evidences for the Christian faith, especially his the evidence he presents for Christ's bodily resurrection. I think there needs to be more discussion of that contribution by William Paley. Just as, that portion of Pascal's argumentation or apologetic methodology is often ignored as well. So what I'd like to do now is just kind of move forward to the 20th century and on into the 21st century. I think most of these guys are still alive. Now, what we've actually been covering is what would be called, you could call it classical apologetics. Or traditional apologetics, okay? Some people refer to it as evidentialism, okay? Others would say, no, evidentialism deals with historical evidences, and classical apologetics, you have to at least start with arguments for God's existence, but for all practical purposes, these three words are often used interchangeably, okay? And so what I'm going to do now is look at some of the 20th century, and now there's some of the big-name 21st century evidentialists or classical or traditional apologists. Then what we'll start doing tomorrow, we'll start looking at the Reformed contribution to apologetics. And I'll talk about what I think John Calvin's apologetic methodology was. I know this is Western Reformed Seminary, so please be gentle with me, because if you lined up the five greatest Reformed apologists, okay, of the 20th century, they would all claim that their apologetic methodology, they got it from Calvin. Yet, they would all disagree. So in other words, even among Reformed scholars, there's no unanimous decision as to what exactly Calvin was talking about in those first few pages of the Institutes, when he talked about, kind of evidence or clues of God in nature. And so, I'll just give you, I think Bernard Ram, I think he got it right on that. But then we'll talk about, Cornelius II, Gordon Clark. We'll talk about Alvin Plantinga. We'll talk about Parnell Schaefer. It's a tremendous contribution to apologetics. But most of the Reformed scholars, with, the notable exceptions of R.C. Sproul and Gerstner and Lindsley, most of the Reformed scholars frown upon classical apologetics, okay? Some embrace it, but most frown upon it, and that's why you have what's called presuppositionalism. There's different types of presuppositionalism. You also hear of verificationalism, and we'll talk about those different types, okay? Now, let me say this, one more point about all this stuff that we covered. If you notice, there were a lot of similarities in the thinking of people in among the classical or traditional apologists, okay? Especially since they were all providing evidence for the Christian faith and all. But at the same time, you get to Pascal, and he's quite different. I mean, from the other traditional apologists. In fact, I even argue Descartes was quite different from most traditional apologists. And so, it just amazes me that we just don't recognize Pascalian apologetics as a whole separate category from, I mean, classical apologists, if there's one thing in common, they like arguments for God's existence. I mean, even when you get to Occam, and he didn't think that the arguments for God's existence proved God's existence with certainty, he still used them because he thought they were true with a high degree of probability. So, and then Pascal pops on the picture. He doesn't like the traditional arguments at all. He just sweeps them away with a couple of passages and moves on. So it seems to me like we've got an entirely separate, unique apologetic methodology, Pascalian apologetics. And we need to give him his due. So what I want to talk about is Norman Geisler. He's often referred to in evangelical circles as the godfather of 20th century apologetics. And the other guys, either directly or indirectly, his pupils, William Lane Craig, J.P. Moreland, and my old professor from Liberty University, Gary Habermas, his great guy, more than, I know all four of these guys, but Moreland, Craig, and Habermas are just dynamite brothers of the Lord. I mean, you guys are as too, but you don't, just don't want to, if you disagree with guys, you want to be like on the other end of the country. He's got that Gordon Clark streak in him where, you know, top quality debater, and he's competitive. He's got to win that debate. And so whatever the case, Norman Geisler, probably the work I would recommend, well, I probably read about 30 or 40 of his works. He's a traditional apologist. He considers himself a Thomist, and he's probably closer to being a true Thomist than like R.C. Sproul is. At the same time, there are some differences. Like, he's willing to use the Quran cosmological argument, the argument from the beginning of the universe, whereas Aquinas would not do that. One of the things I like about him is he's one of the few traditional apologists who has taken some of the presuppositional objections to heart. Okay? Now, but he hasn't abandoned traditional apologetics, but he has fine-tuned it. And in his Christian apologetics, one of the three books that I'm recommending of his Christian apologetics, he gives about a 2 or 3 page summary of Gordon Clark and a 2 or 3 page summary of Cornelius Van Til. And remember, you know, Sproul, Gerstner, and Lindsley, they did this book trying to refute Van Til, and all they proved to me was they didn't even understand Van Til, and Van Til was one of the former props. So, I mean, they did a good job in defending the faith, but they misunderstood Van Til. And, you know, I read all these books on Van Til and the pupils of Van Til writing about him, like John Frame writing about Van Til and Greg Bonson writing about Van Til, huge books. Read all the stuff on Van Til, and then I read like 25 books of Gordon Clark. And Gordon Clark, sometimes there would just be sentence after sentence, I would disagree with him, but I never knew how to refute him. So he just kind of like, you know, it makes for a real stressful read. But I went through all this work, you know, reading 50, 60, 70, 80 books just to figure out Clark and Van Til. And then I reread the 6 pages in Geisler, and Geisler had done all that research before, and he's able to summarize it on 2 or 3 pages. He thoroughly understood the thought. Even Van Til's pupils couldn't figure him out, but Geisler could only figure him out, but spell it out fairly. A view that he himself doesn't hold in just 3 or 4 pages. But his Christian apologetics, that's heavy stuff. So is his philosophy of religion. If you're one of that Dr. Battle's students, you can handle it, okay? If you haven't read much, you know, theology or philosophy or apologetics, then I'd recommend his book, When Skeptics Ask. Now there's a new one. He co-authored one of his former students, and the guy's from New Jersey, so you know it's going to be good. And, but it's with Frank Turek. It's I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, is the title of the book. And it's real, it's so basic that when I'm reading it, it simplifies stuff so much that it's hard to realize that they're not losing any of the force of their arguments. So they just did a really good job explaining it. So I really recommend that. You can get that for 11, 12 bucks from Christian book distributors. I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. So whatever the case, I'm going to just give you a little summary of Geisler's Christian Apologetics book. And again, this is not a fun read unless you really like torturing yourself with philosophical stuff. Because the whole first one-third of the book deals with nothing but methodology. What kind of method do we have to use to find truth? How do we find truth? Now, if you're, you know, this is like a 400-page book, so we're talking about like 130, 140, 150 pages just trying to answer one question, how do we find truth? Okay? So now, if you're salivating right now, then you need to buy this book. If you're not, if you're thinking, man, why would anybody even write such a thing, then get, you know, when skeptics ask for the, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. But his section on methodology, How do we find truth? First, he says that agnosticism, the idea that man can't know truth, that fails. Because the claim that man cannot know is a claim to know something. You're claiming to know that man cannot know it. So it's self-refuting, it can't be true. Then he says pure rationalism. Now he's taking on Descartes. Pure rationalism fails because, you know, through reason alone, we can show that something might be contradictory. So we can prove what is false, but just because something is non-contradictory, it might not automatically be true. So it's good as a negative test for truth. It can prove to us what's false in some instances, but it can't necessarily prove what is true just all alone, just all by itself. And then he says that, you know, if you can prove everything through reason alone, and Pascal points this out too, but Geiger says if you can prove everything through reason, if you think you can prove everything through reason alone, you'd have to also prove your first principles with reason alone. So you'd have to prove your starting points through reason alone. But that's a problem, because then your starting points are not your starting points, because you've got reasons for that. So they're your starting points, but then they're not your starting points, because you've got to, if you can prove everything through reason alone, you got to prove them. Give reasons for why you believe that, and then give reasons for why you believe those. And you get an infinite regress. Reason never gets started. By the way, that was one of the most powerful points that Gordon Clark made. Geisler got that from Gordon Clark. Okay? That's why Gordon Clark, the guy who called his view dogmatic presuppositionalism, he was a rationalist. He believed reason worked. At the same time, you realize reason can never get started if you could prove everything through reason alone. So you've got to dogmatically presuppose something. And he said, you know what? When I dogmatically presuppose the existence of the triune God who revealed himself in Scripture and the law of non-contradiction, it makes sense out of everything. But if I try any other presupposition, it doesn't work. I mean, it's like with Gordon Clark, it's like, if worldviews are trees, it's like Gordon Clark to stand in the middle of a forest and you take a photo of him, and the Christian tree is still standing, and it's like he's on video and it's panning back, and you see all these trees that have been chopped out. That's what he's done. He's using the law of non-contradiction. He just chops down one worldview, another worldview, another worldview, and then people say, well, how do you know Christianity is true? The only tree still standing, ain't it? It's like, you know, end of story. But, and Geiger got that from him, is that reasons, it's got to start somewhere. You can't prove everything through reason alone. Geiger said that finism or irrationalism fails because it's not a test for truth, because it doesn't even believe you're supposed to test truth claims. It just believes. But at the same time, the fideist, who is an irrationalist, doesn't like reason, but you have to assume the law of non-contradiction. Just to be a fideist, just to say, well, I don't believe in reason. Well, I don't believe in the law of non-contradiction. I'm an irrationalist. Well, just to reject the law of non-contradiction means you have to assume it. You have to use it. Okay? When I was speaking to a class of postmodernist philosophy students at the University of Washington, one of the students, they were having a hard time understanding me, and so one of the students said, you might be thinking, yeah, them too. But he said, wait, what you're saying is that if I can't speak, I can't even speak without contradicting my worldview. And I said, well, that's true, but that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying you can't even think without contradicting your worldview, because the postmodernist denies absolute truth. But just to say, you know, just to think, right, absolute truth does not exist. Well, that would be an absolute truth then, yeah. So whatever the case, fideism, irrationalism, we try to say we don't use reason to find truth at all. You know, and I mean, how do you defend, if you're a Phidias, how do you defend your Phidias? With reason. It's like postmoderns, they say, oh, you have no stories. There's no, forget propositional truth. And so you have these postmodern Christians now in the emerging church. I went to the Evangelical Theological Society, and a guy read a boring 20-minute paper about how we should no longer use propositional truth to defend the Christian faith. We should just tell stories. And because he wanted Christianity to be postmodern. And all these evangelical professors, I'm like, oh, he's so profound and everything. So I thought, let me see if I can pop the pope. So I raised my hands. And, you know, they didn't know who I was. So the guy called on me and I said, I didn't hear any stories. Everything got real quiet. He said, what? And I said, I didn't hear any stories. I thought you were going to tell me a story. But you sounded like a modernist because you were using all this propositional truth. And you're using rational argumentation to argue that we shouldn't use rational argumentation. We should just tell stories when we defend our views. I didn't hear any stories. Can you tell me a story? And believe it or not, all the professors got mad at me. Like I was a heckler. Like, oh, come on, guys. Ignore the accent. Ignore that I sound like a cab driver. And just listen to what I said. I totally, you know, I just kind of sat there. I had too much pride to just get up and walk out. So. But it's funny what we evangelicals entertain. Experientialism fails, Geiser says, because no experience, you know, some people say, well, just religious experience just proves itself. The Bible says no experience is self-interpreting. You could have conflicting truth claims based on experience that cannot be tested. But I'll say that I firmly believe that my experience of the Lord Jesus Christ is true. And that Jesus has proven himself to me not just through the scriptures, not just through reason, not just through historical evidences, but just because of my relationship with the Lord Jesus. Okay? I'm convinced of that. At the same time, what we need to realize is it's really hard to have that as the sole case for Christianity when the Buddhist or the Hindu is saying he's having an experience with his God. Okay? You're going to need something more than subjective experience to deal with things. Now, and I'll tell you, subjective experience, I mean, when you look at the life of Wilberforce, when you look at the life of John Newton, who wrote Amazing Grace, there's more than subjective experience there. When that subjective experience produces a transformed life, even the Apostle Paul and the Apostle James, the half-brother of Jesus, they are still, their transformed lives are still two of the strongest pieces of evidence for Jesus' bodily resurrection from the dead. All New Testament scholars acknowledge that Paul, even the Jesus Seminar, Paul really thought he had an experience of the resurrected Christ long after Christ's death, and that experience on the road to Damascus transformed his life. And most New Testament scholars will acknowledge that when Paul quotes that creed in 1 Corinthians 15, that James probably also met his big half-brother after Jesus had died. He appeared to him, risen from the dead. And, you know, I mean, let's face it, if you're going to believe he rose as Messiah and God, it's going to take a bodily resurrection. But James was a martyr. There's no reason for the apostles to report that. I mean, it's bad public relations unless he really was a mocker. And then he went from a mocker to one of the leaders in the early church of Jerusalem. And the resurrection is the explanation. But experience is that experience. That's not a sufficient or adequate test. And then he says evidentialism fails. What he's looking there is just that the facts, empirical facts. And here he's kind of attacking another traditional apologist, John Wirt Montgomery, a Lutheran scholar, who acted like, well, if you can prove the resurrection, you can prove Jesus is God. And by the way, I don't think Geiser fully does justice to Montgomery. Montgomery was, I think, a lot smarter than Geiser leads you to believe. But I just think that in the 1960s, you know, if you prove the resurrection in a culture that has been influenced by Christianity, you provide evidence for the resurrection, everything else just automatically follows. And by the time you get to the 1990s, one philosopher said that it used to be that we had to prove that that God exists and that Jesus rose from the dead. Now as we enter the 21st century, we're going to have to prove that only one God exists and only Jesus rose from the dead. I mean, it's just like, you know, nowadays everybody and their mother's brother thinks he or she is a God. And so it's a different world. But facts don't come with built-in interpretations. We interpret the facts by our worldviews and not the other way around. So guys are saying, you've got to deal with the worldview question first. Look at evolution and creation, common anatomy in animals. The evolutionist says, therefore, common ancestry. The Christian says, therefore, common designer. Okay? So we've got different worldviews, different colored sunglasses through which we're interpreting the facts. And so he says it's not enough. You've got to deal with the worldview issues before you look at the empirical evidence. He says pragmatism fails. Pragmatism is, you know, when you try to say that, whatever works is true, okay? Now, Geiser says all true must ultimately work, but everything that works isn't necessarily true. Often lies work. We can't always see the long-range results. See, Francis Schaeffer showed the livability of Christianity is somewhat of a pragmatic argument. The way he used it, I think, worked. Okay? But in the general sense, you just can't say, well, whatever works must be true. You know, the doctor might, you know, you go for surgery and the doctor lies and says, I do these all the time. The 99% chance you're going to make it, don't worry about it, just be positive. And the guy's lying. It's the first time he's ever done this procedure. It's never been done before by him, but it's been done by others. It was about a 40% success rate, okay? But you get real confident, and that helps, and you end up surviving this operation. The lie worked, but it was still a lie. Just because something works doesn't mean that it's true. Now, ultimately, I think pragmatism is a really good test, because in the end, only Christianity is going to work. And a lot of people are going to find out the hard way that it's the only thing that works and really does bring fulfillment to our lives as we spend eternity with Christ. And then Geiser says, this is Geiser at his weakest. I think combinationalism fails. So if you can combine all these other ones together, and remember I told you I'm like Bonaventure? I never read an argument for God's existence I didn't like. I'm real eclectic. I love taking different apologetic ammunition from presuppositionalists and traditionalists. But God just says combinationalism fails. Adding leaky buckets will still not hold water. And adding inadequate solutions does not give us an adequate solution. That's true in one sense, but in another sense, you can use combinational type arguments or cumulative case type arguments where, you could say, well, I think Joe Schmo committed the murder. I know Joe Schmo. He wouldn't commit the murder. The gun. The murder weapon was registered in his name. Well, that doesn't mean anything. Somebody else could have got it. Yeah, but it was found in his hand. Well, where was it found in his hand? Well, he was standing over the victim, and there was still smoke coming out of the gun. And it's like, well, he might have showed up on the scene and picked up the gun for all I know. Yeah, when the officer showed up, he was shaking his head saying, why did I do that? I just ruined my life. Why did I do that? Guys who might say leaky buckets, I'm saying electric chair time, okay? These cases get stronger and stronger. So, with leaky buckets, where is the leak, Dr. Geiser? okay? If the leak is in the bottom, so that the, if you got a bucket and it has no bottom, yeah, then it can't hold any water. So no matter how many buckets you get, you think, well, I only have, or I have, you know, 50 buckets with no bottoms. So, but as long as I fill all of them up with water, then I'll get enough. Then guys are right, okay? Put the hoser in the middle or the top, so each one holds a little bit of water. Eventually, you're gonna be able to get a whole lot of water. And so in cumulative case, you said, well, this might be, you know, this particular argument might be a little convincing here, and this one might add probably a little bit more. And then when you start lining these up, and there doesn't seem to be hardly any evidence on the other side, you've got a strong case. So I think he's kind of weak there. Parnell was real big on combinationalism. I think he did a really good job with that. So I think Geiser pushes that away a little bit too soon. So Geiser says, well, what are the adequate tests for truth? And lo and behold, the only adequate test for truth of Geiser's way of doing things, his Thomistic way of doing things, that's usually the way it is with these great minds, okay? And I don't claim to be a great mind. I claim to be a guy who reads some of these great Christian minds and then steal a little bit from them, steal a little bit from them. And like Milton Berle with comedy, you just got to know where to steal your material from and have a successful apologetic career. But the adequate test for truth, first he uses what he calls unaffirmability, which basically is the test for the falsity of worldviews. In other words, whatever is self-refuting can't be true. And so, you know, if you're trying to affirm that the physical world doesn't exist, okay, that's coming pretty close to, you know, I mean, a pantheist, when he tries to convince you that pantheism is true, that's one mind trying to convince you, another mind, that only one mind exists. Okay? Good luck. I mean, that's, pantheism is self-refuting at its core, unaffirmability. Number two, actual undeniability, the test for truth of what we see. See, Geisler is not going for logical necessity, nor was Aquinas. See, Aquinas was not an ultra-rationalist. Descartes was going for logical necessity, logical certainty. The logical certainty means it has to be true, because to deny it involves contradiction. Okay? So it has to be true, logically. With Geisler and Aquinas, you're dealing with the realm of being, okay? And they're not just the realm of knowing and the realm of reason, but the realm of being. So it's actual undeniability. And that would be the test of the truth of a worldview. So so what Geisler would say is that, you know, if you try to deny your existence, you have to actually exist in order to make the denial. So that has to be false. That's actual unaffirmability. Okay? And so, whatever the case, he would say, so it's actually undeniable that I exist. And that's how he begins his argument for God's existence. And then he argues that he's a finite, changing thing, and comes up with this cosmological argument for God's existence. So now, what he's doing is he's taking these first two tests, okay? Unaffirmability shows what's false, what worldviews are false. Actual undeniability shows which worldview is true, okay? And then, what he does beyond that, then he brings combinationalism. So he's saying combinationalism is okay once you get to the proper point. So then all of a sudden the leaky bucket analogy doesn't show up again. And so he calls it systematic coherence, the test for truth statements within a worldview. And so consistency, it must be non-contradictory, then it has to be empirically adequate, it must explain all the relevant facts of the world in which we live, and it must be experientially relevant, it must be livable. So it's got to be non-contradictory, it's got to explain to that in question, and it must be livable. Okay, are we going to go to questions, or, okay, we'll go to questions at this point. And Dr. Battle informed me if you ask a question, you get an extra cookie. Okay, two extra cookies.
So if somebody wanted to study undergraduate philosophy, can you recommend some colleges where you send young people?
And you mean like young Christians, or?
Yes.
Yeah.
College age.
Yeah, and it's Biola, I think, is really good. And they've actually, they've got William Lane Craig, they've got J.P. Wong, although the undergraduates aren't going to see much of them. They might see a little bit of Douglas Guy, but they've got so many good guys. They've got like a dream team of thinkers. I know that Liberty has always had really good, Liberty University, where I went, really good philosophy profs. Dr. Abermatt doesn't do much teaching anymore. He's more of a research prof. Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, I believe, they're still doing a pretty good job teaching philosophy, though. A lot's going to depend where the student is and how grounded they are, because you can get a good philosophical education from atheist skeptical profs, as long as you're solid enough that they don't destroy your faith. But I'm a little bit concerned with evangelical seminaries right now. We're more likely to hire, if somebody's got a PhD degree through Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, and he signs a statement of faith, and another guy's got a PhD from Princeton, and he signs a statement of faith, if there's some question about whether this guy really is one of us, the guy from Princeton's going to get the job more times than not in most seminaries. And I think we're hurting ourselves here. And now we're getting some pretty, quote-unquote, conservative seminaries that have some props teaching that God doesn't infallibly foretell future free choices and also. So I think the number of schools is getting lower and lower. New Testament studies, I like Master's College. It seems like they've got all the guys who have the courage to say that Mark didn't write first. They're going to, back to an independent theory. Now, that's the theory I hold, though. I'm not saying I'm positive that that's right, that the Synoptic Gospels were actually written separately. But you would think somebody in the latter half of the 20th century would still hold to that. And I like Henry Thiessen and his systematic theology. He's got one little paragraph in there. He says the only reason why so many liberal New Testament scholars say that Mark wrote first is because it's the, one of the reasons is because he wasn't an eyewitness who knew Jesus. They don't want the eyewitnesses to write. But then number two is the shortest gospel, and they were so influenced by evolution that everything evolves from the simple to the complex. And I mean, that's a dumb reason for assuming that Mark wrote first, but Thiessen held an independent theory that the gospels were written independently. So I just threw out a few names for philosophical education, but Westminster, I haven't been following them as of late, both in California and Philadelphia, but historically, I mean, you go back to the Van Til days, but it's still that way where, they're still, you guys know it, I'm preaching to the choir, but they're old school. When you learn, I mean, just like read Charles Hodge, just denied theology. You get theology in dialogue with the latest cutting edge. I mean, 1875, the guy's writing. He's got over 100 pages refuting Darwinian evolution, which came out in The Origin of Species, 1859. I mean, Most of you don't have even heard, you know, the latest evolutionary theory until, you know, 50, 60 years. I mean, we're just finding out about quantum physics, which goes back to, you know, early 20th century. But I was on top of it. He'd tell you how our theological views, how to bounce that off of the current scientific, the current philosophical views. So it used to be if you just were trained in theology, you were automatically trained in philosophy and apologetics and anywhere where science overlapped with our beliefs. Nowadays, everything is everybody's so specialized, everything is separate, and most of our seminaries and colleges don't even, it's like the world's teaching philosophy, really bad philosophy, but the church isn't teaching it at all, and we're losing debates to really bad philosophers, and it shouldn't be that way, and so hopefully that helps a little bit, but Southern Evangelical Seminary, somebody like Geisler, they now have an undergraduate program there, but it's like, you know, it's like 50 guys all teaching Norman Geisler's way to defend the faith. I'm not saying there's nothing bad about that. I mean, but if you want Geisler, that's the place to go in North Carolina, Southern Evangelical Seminary.
How serious do you think the assault on the resurrection of Christ is with this recent archaeological find and television program about it?
Yeah, I've just been asked to speak on, like, what is it, April 21st at an apologetics conference on that, and when I watched it, when I watched the program, my own faith wasn't knocked around, but I really thought this was going to be way more, you know, much more of a demonic, a vicious attack on the Christian faith than the Da Vinci Code, for instance, which was really way out there. But by the time the night was over, I really was bummed out that they actually asked me to speak on it. And April 21st, but I don't know if anybody, I wouldn't go to hear on it because, I don't know, anybody watch it? The Discovery Channel, the last two Majidas, they said, look, we found the ossuary, the blue, you know, they grab you in a shroud, and for a year, then they wait for your body to decompose, then they go back into the tomb, and they clean the bones, and they take them apart. And these ossuaries just have to be little boxes longer than your thigh bones, the longest bone in the body. And they put the bones in there. Well, they found, they're talking about this, they found this tomb with a Jesus, the bones of Jesus, the son of Joseph. There was a Miriam there, a Mariamne, something like that, another version of Mary. Joseph, son of Jesus. Then there was a Matthew with no description. And then there was another ossuary, but it had been missing. And this guy claimed it was missing right around the time that the ossuary James, the brother, the James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus, was found. So they're claiming that was probably that one. And so I thought, oh man, people are going to buy this. I had no idea Ted Koppel was going to come on right after the program and just almost single-handedly when I watched Ted Koppel, he was usually, you know, bullying somebody who believed what I believed. But here, Ted Koppel, I guess, did enough investigation on it, and he had two archaeologists first. The five people that didn't believe it, you know, and he had the two producers or the, you know, on the other side. But first he had two archaeologists, then he had three New Testament scholars come on. At one time, Darrell Mott was the only legitimate evangelical Christian. I think there was a Catholic priest who was kind of wishy-washy, but it seemed like he believed in the resurrection. But the other three were just very clearly not. In fact, one just came around and said, "I am not a believer." But they were insulted. They were archaeologists who were insulted that you could use this to deceive people and make them think this is what archaeology is all about. And one of the archaeologists referred to, this guy was ticked. He looked like the kid, I don't know if anyone remembers the whole series Lost in Space. The kid with the reddish hair and he had a beard and mustache, like he's trying to make himself look older. But he was just ticked, and he referred to it as archaeoporn. And so he said, like pornography is a total perversion of what God meant human sexuality to be. And he's saying what these guys did tonight is a total perversion of what archaeology is all about. That tomb was actually found in the 1980s by some of the world's leading archaeologists. And by the way, in that part of the world, most of the world's leading archaeologists were either atheists or they're Jews, you know. So, I mean, not exactly the kinds of guys who are Bible-believing Christians. So a lot of these guys are more than willing to try to disprove Jesus. But, you know, they see Jesus, son of Joseph. I mean, that's like John, the son of Joe, today. I mean, it didn't do anything for them. They found a Miriam there, and then a Marianne or whatever, and Joseph, son of, you know, and the thing is, see, what these guys do, if they don't tell you, they do all these probability statistics and all this other stuff. Okay, who's Matthew? Why would Jesus have, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, why in the world would he have Matthew? Is that Matthew the apostle? Is that Matthew, some other son? Who's this Matthew? So acting like that's further evidence, that's not further evidence. You wouldn't expect to find that in Jesus' tomb, assuming that he did not rise. So that's one problem. And then, you know, you got Dan Brown saying that Jesus had a girl named Sarah, and now all of a sudden he's got a son named Joseph. I mean, it's like, what's going on here? Then the archaeologist said that they're not even sure that the name is Jesus. That it's not really clear that it could be another name that's real similar to it. They tested the blood of the DNA of the bones of the Jesus guy, which is a very common name, with the DNA of the bones of Marianne, and what they found was they weren't related. So they said, okay, well then that's evidence that this is Mary Magdalene who married Jesus and stuff, and it just, but so he's assuming to, the only evidence for most a connection of most of those people, most of those names, getting beyond, you know, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, okay, the only connection there would be if you really believe stuff that went back to maybe the 4th or 5th century AD, Gnostic heretical writings that started to talk about Mary Magdalene being real close to Jesus. My own view, you know, I think Mary Magdalene was an elderly lady. All the ladies she hung out with were elderly. Okay? The only reason why everybody thinks Mary Magdalene was a former prostitute, I mean, scriptures only say that Jesus cast 7 demons out of her. She was wealthy, and she was one of the lucky ladies that supported his ministry. She was the first to see the empty tomb, the first to see the risen Lord. But she hung out with elderly ladies. She was named after the town that she was from, Mary Magdalene. She was from Magdala. So that means she wasn't married. If she got married, she would be married, wife of whoever she married. And there's no real evidence for the scenario. He makes this assumption that you would expect to find all these, and you don't. I think we've got something like, I don't have my notes with me on this, but I think we've got something like 20 different ossuaries that have been found of guys named Jesus. See, the thing is, too, is we think, you know, we think, well, Jesus was this common of a name back then, and Joseph was this common, and Mary was this common. Okay, let me tell you something. They need to research that more, because two steps they need to take. One is they need to say, yes, but among devout Jews, especially in the Jerusalem area, those names are even more common. Okay? Evidence of that, just read through the Gospels. You'll find about 10 ladies' names, and like 7 of them are Mary. Okay? You'll find Josephs all over the place. So much that some, you know, if a guy's name is Joseph, and we know from history the guy's name, first name is Joseph, he'll go by one of his other names when he's mentioned in the scriptures. Because to say Joseph, he said absolutely nothing. I mean, whose name's not Joseph? Okay? And so these combinations with James and Joseph and Jesus, it's so common that in 1980, archaeologists who would have loved to, you know, been famous for disproving Jesus, it was obvious to them that this is just a common tomb, and probably a family and some servants, and they're just common names, and it was like, you know, no major deal. There is strong evidence for the resurrection that has to be explained away. If you're going to even begin that kind of thing, you got to explain the change life of James, change life of Paul, why Orthodox Jews would change the day of worship to Sunday. When they were celebrating Saturday, it was like celebrating creation. Some event bigger than creation had to occur for them to say, okay, God wants us to gather on Sunday. Jesus rose on Sunday, and most, if not all, the post-resurrection appearances were on Sunday. So you've got all this evidence for the resurrection. Virtually every New Testament scholar believes Jesus was crucified. Crucifixion leaves marks. Sometimes it leaves the spike in there. Yohani, they couldn't get the spike out of the poor guy. They put him in a shroud with a spike at his feet. But it leaves evidence in the bones. I didn't hear anything about that. So, but you know, John Donovan Crossman was on the show and saying that, oh yeah, this is a... John Donovan Crossman's life has been devoted to the wild speculative theory that Jesus wasn't buried. His corpse was thrown into a common grave with other criminals, and his body was eaten by wild beasts. Now, if he really believed that was Jesus' bones there, then that disproved, that basically destroys his scholarship and his research for the last 30 years. Yet he somehow comes out looking like a hero. So it was just a big game that was being played, and Ted Koppel of all people just demolished it in 1 hour. So anybody who stayed and watched that 1 hour would see that this was not good archaeology. This is just wild speculation.
Would you lead us in prayer?
Sure. Father, in Jesus Christ's name, I just thank you again for these people and their patience, and then their love for you and their love for your word, and their desire to not only share the faith with others, but to defend the faith as well. And so I pray, Lord, that in some way, shape, or form, some of the things that I've said tonight, the last 2 nights, or I'm going to say the next 2 days, I pray, Lord, that those would be the words that you want said, and that they would be words that would help these people, not only to share the faith, but to defend the faith once for all, the liberties of the saints. I pray that you bless this church, and you bless the seminary, and that you bless the people here, and we just love you, Lord, and help us to build your kingdom. And not alone. Jesus' precious name we pray.
Amen. I might mention that